On this episode of TWiT, Microsoft gets a facelift, Google lights up their fiber, gaming gets pwned, oh, and also Shearer's on the carpet, Justin starts a new show, and Brian's cooking babies. Stay tuned for TWiT.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Audio bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by the new WinApp for Android, featuring wireless sync and one-click iTunes import. Now with free daily music downloads and full-length CD listening parties. Download it for free at winamp.com/android. Video bandwidth for TWiT is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 380, recorded November 18, 2012. One Night Stand.
This Week in Tech is brought to you by Go to Assist from Citrix. Take control of your IT world from one simple cloud-based platform. Provide live or unattended support to all your users anywhere. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToAssist.com. Use the promo code TWiT. And by Ford, featuring available sync. Now you can control your media player with simple voice commands. Enjoy your drive while you easily search and listen to your favorite songs. Check it out on the 2012 Ford Focus and at Ford.com/technology. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your iPhone, iPad, MacBook, or other smartphone. Find out what your gadget's worth at Gazelle.com. And by FreshBooks. FreshBooks is a cloud accounting service for small businesses that saves time and gets you paid faster. Join over 5 million FreshBooks users and try the service free for 30 days of unlimited use at FreshBooks.com. Be sure to let them know you heard about it on TWiT.
It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. It's the show where we grab tech by the ankles and shake it until sense falls out of its pockets. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit. I'm in for Leo Laporte, the tech guy, who is currently having an Aussie holiday down under. You know, going on walkabout with some dingoes, or maybe throwing a shrimp on the barbie with a koala. And Uncle Leo wants you to remember, TWiT, it's Australian for podcast. Of course, I'm not alone. I'm joined by a fantastic panel, starting on my right with Mr. Brian Brushwood. That's right, Schwood himself, the magician extraordinaire, the businessman who raised, what was it, $33,000 in an Indiegogo?
$1 billion, yes. I can verify I'm a trillionaire, and I don't get to keep any of it because apparently postage is $1 billion, and it was the worst decision I ever made. You must have written that intro in advance. That was too good to be off the cuff.
No. I just had someone remind me what an Australian accent sounded like, and thanks to Justin for that.
Okay, right on. Hey, speaking of which, Justin Robert Young.
That's right. Sitting next to me, Justin Robert Young Go Game fame. He is a professional muse. He brings inspiration out of people, and of course, host of Weird Things and our own NSFW show. Justin, thank you for coming in.
Pleasure to be here, Robert.
And I'm sorry. You remind me of somebody. Just looking at you, I'm thinking,
is it like Brad Pitt?
Oh, well, no. That's right. Edward James Olmos. Yes. So Commander Adama in his younger days. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. We have spared no expense. We brought in Battlestar Galactica. That's how much we
love. I'm closer to Blade Runner than Battlestar. I'm not that old just yet. But really, this is all complete nonsense because we have yet to introduce our final panelist, who's really the anchor, our cleanup hitter here.
Because we are a tech show, we thought that we should actually bring in a tech journalist. And that's why we brought in Miss Shira Lazar from, what's trending? Shira, what's going on? And thanks for coming on the show.
This is my hello.
There we go.
You know what I realized? You look like the guy from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. That's who you remind me of.
I'll tell you, I've gotten that a couple times.
This has been the curse of Justin Robert Young. He sounds like Charlie Day as well. And in fact, there was a time on NSFW where I played a clip of Charlie Day and Justin actually thought it was himself. So this is a play.
No, that's definitely happened before, despite the fact that I adamantly say I don't sound like him. But Shira, I feel like every time that you come on a show, people should just aggressively ask you what's trending. Like, that's how every conversation should begin.
It is. The meetings I have, be like, and that's trending. It's like the constant joke. But yeah, we have a daily live interactive show at youtube.com/whatstrending where we curate the videos on YouTube that you should be watching, including all these stars and celebrities on the platform. And we describe it as what MTV was to music videos, we are to YouTube videos and the culture around it. So it's really fun. We have a blast. You know, it's a brand that we're just growing. It's just the beginning. And so I encourage everyone to check it out.
No, you guys do a great job. You guys do a really, really good job.
And like Inara on Firefly, you bring some respectability to the ship that we call Twit. How about that?
I get that. Did you script that one too? You scripted that one.
No, that was just.
No, these are just iron clad transitions.
Rolling off the tongue. But let's start off.
I want so bad for the camera to pan over and just see one of the interns holding up cue cards for you guys.
We could set that up. That's fantastic. Let's start off with the first big story, which is also a story that I think a lot of us are sick of.
Again, a lot of people who listen to Twit, you know, this is their wrap up for the week in tech. They don't have time to just stay, you know, on the stories like we do here, you know, at the network. If you listen to Tech News Today and Windows Weekly, obviously the big story is Steve Sinofsky out at Microsoft, the head of Windows, now no more.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these stories that everyone talked about ad nauseum for the past week. There are a lot of rumors about why it happened, about people who liked him, didn't like him, about his business strategy, about the fact that he's been with Microsoft since, I believe, 1988, 1989. Shira, what have you heard that you can share with us? I mean, we know that there's some conflict between him and Ballmer, but the rest of it is really just the stuff of rumor.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the whole company needs a new beginning in a way. Like Microsoft, the relevancy of the company, it's just not relevant anymore. And when you have people and employees and leaders that have been around since the 80s, I mean, things aren't the same as they were in the 80s. And to really innovate this day and age, you need to bring in some new blood. I mean, even Ballmer, like at CES, whenever he gives his CES speeches, it feels off, right? I mean, and they try to be new and hot and relevant, and they're just not. And I think that with him out now, obviously we're all sick of this, but hopefully it will allow for some new blood to come in to really kind of give it some revamping, right? I mean, it's so crazy. Like Microsoft, we're in Venice right now where Google just created headquarters, and now Microsoft is moving in this area as well, which is wild.
They did their big Surface announcement initially in LA, right? Culver City?
It was big. And even John Chu, who, you know, directs all of Justin Bieber's movies and music videos, you know, he directed their commercial. And so you see they're trying to have that cool factor to them right now. Yeah. And that involves changing up the executive level players.
Well, in the context of what's happening now, though, the question is, and I don't know if we have a good answer for it, what is this a referendum on a Windows 8, the sales of Windows 8, or if where they want to go with Windows as a platform? Brian, I mean, do you think that this is?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I was going to ask. Obviously, I think we probably are all on the same page that if Windows 8 was a breakaway success, we probably wouldn't see an upheaval like this. But it makes me wonder behind the scenes if there were certain decisions that he took personal responsibility for, and that now that Windows 8 has had a relatively soft launch, that he's having to pay the price for.
Yeah, I did hear something from a source close to the matter who mentioned that even if Windows 8 had been a first-day blockbuster success, everyone in the world decided to dump their Windows 7 computers and upgrade to Windows 8, that Sinofsky still would have been out. His take was this has been building for a while because there's so much resentment of the guy. The fact that he set Microsoft divisions against each other. He wanted Live to compete with Office, to compete with Windows, to compete with what other divisions they've got on campus. And that doesn't match the new Windows 8 philosophy, the whole one UI, multiple platforms. This source of mine was essentially saying they didn't want to change Sinofsky before the Windows 8 launch because, well, you know, he was the guiding force behind it. But once it did launch, and once it they saw that it wasn't going to be a runaway success, but it's still going to sell millions of copies, they didn't see a reason to keep
it around.
Don't
let the start button hit you on the butt on the way out. Right.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, now, we've actually got a clip here from Windows Weekly. So this past week, Paul Theroux on Windows Weekly talked about his interactions with Sinofsky, and he described him as basically a petty and vindictive man. Let's take a listen.
He was talking to somebody over on the side after the event or in a break during the event. I walked up and I kind of waited, and they stopped talking for a second. I said, look, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Paul Theroux. And he did this thing where he kind of stepped back and he looked me up and down, and then he just went right back to talking to the other guy. Just completely blew me off. And I thought to myself, well, I'm never going to be buddies with this guy, I guess. So,
yeah, that's just one story. What were you going to say, Brian?
I mean, it sounds like petty and vindictive. I saw that in the doc, and I was wondering where that came from. But, you know, firsthand account like that, I mean, we live in an age where personality definitely matters. And in a world where one bad mistreatment can have ripples, throughout the blogosphere, you can't afford to be that D-bag.
Can you not, though? Like, if you're delivering the numbers, I mean, we are rife with stories of the warrior CEO who makes the hard decisions and ticks people off, but does it for, the greater success that comes after. We lionize, we mythologize these people, including, most notably probably Steve Jobs.
Sure, so, Jobs, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the person that you would immediately think of. Mm-hmm. I mean, if he had success, I mean, I can't imagine that if everybody was like, well, clearly this is the way forward. We're seeing clear lines of success, not only with Windows 8, but 10 years down the road, that Sinofsky would still be there.
Yeah. As you're saying, yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, if you see success. And I wanted to say something. Someone tweeted me at TechAU, goes, Shira Lazar says Microsoft is no longer relevant. Completely disagree. And I think it's not saying that they're irrelevant at all. We work actually, I work with a lot of people at Microsoft. So I'm just saying that's not what I'm saying. I just think that any company that's been around for years, you're constantly dealing with, obviously other huge brands and like Apple who are innovating and they're like the cool, hot company, right? That everyone wants. And you need to find ways to innovate. And it's hard also when you're siloed so much. I think with a company like Microsoft, there's so many parts of it. You have the Xbox, you have Windows, you have the Android, you have Bing now. I mean, like, I think the real success of the company will be when you see all these different divisions of them come together and take advantage of each other. Mm-hmm. And it's about having a leader at the helm of that. So that's what I really meant at Tech AU.
that's the angle I love
Tech
the most.
AU in your face.
No, but when you consider it, I mean, let's look at one example that I use in enterprise all the time. Windows Phone. Windows Phone is actually a really good UI. It's a clean device. It works relatively well. They could have one major advantage, and that is that business runs on Exchange Server. But to make a Windows Phone work properly with an Exchange Server, it's a multi-step process that involves additional licensing, that involves additional purchases. And that's because the Windows Phone division competes with the Exchange division. What they want to do, and I think one of the reasons why they dumped Sinofsky is because they want to say, look, we don't care how each division does. We care about how Microsoft does. And if we can give people a compelling reason to buy a Windows mobile phone, being if you buy it, it automatically works with Exchange. No additional settings, no additional purchases, no additional licensing. The company as a whole will do much better.
Yeah.
It's ease of use, right? Everything, consumers want something easy that will be seamless with all the other gadgets they have. And so you're more likely to have a Microsoft lifestyle, you can say, if all those tools you use connect with each other very easily. But if they make it harder for that to happen, then it won't be as easy for people to do that.
So let me ask, has anyone here actually upgraded to Windows 8? Or I don't know how many of you guys are just all Mac, because, I mean, I'm PC on everything. You have done the upgrade? Do you derive any benefit from the fact that the formerly known as Metro interface is the same one used on the tablets? Or is that just annoying? Or do you wish you had your start button back?
Right. So I've got it on several different computers. I have it on a Acer W700, which is an actual tablet. It's designed to be a Windows tablet. It's a full-on laptop in a tablet format. It actually works really, really well on that. I've also got it on an all-in-one, also from Acer, and it works exceptionally well on that. I upgraded this laptop. This is an S3 to Windows 8, and about 2 days later, I downgraded to Windows 7.
Wow.
If it doesn't have the touchscreen, there's no reason to have Metro. And
that would be your enterprise market.
Would be your enterprise market.
I mean, and that's the thing is when we look at Windows sales, it's not like what Apple does. Apple's a consumer-focused company. They deal with, you know, the lines that you know, stretch around the block. That's big for a company that deals from them to people on the street. For enterprise markets, I mean, you know well before a launch, you know, what your numbers are going to be because they sell these things in bulk and it's a person-to-person contact. I mean, you would know better than anybody, you know, in terms of covering this stuff on Twiat. But, you know, you will know long before the release date of this whether or not it is likely to be a success on the enterprise market, which is such a gigantic part of the lifeblood of Microsoft.
Right. Now, one thing I will say is there's been this sort of hushed murmur in the crowd, in the enterprise crowd, that Windows 8 is actually a decent operating system. It's well done. It is Windows 7 with that additional, what we used to call Metro interface over the top. You could make it suitable for enterprise if you did one thing. That's put the start button back on the desktop mode. If you did that, it basically turns it into Windows 7 with the additional advantage of having the Metro interface. Now, whether or not that's going to happen, who knows? It depends how much Microsoft wants to push 8 into the enterprise, which they really don't have to. I mean, enterprise is going to stick with XP and 7. They've actually made the switch. There are now more 7 machines than there are XP machines.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think who made the comment? Yeah, Apple goes for the consumer level.
Me.
Yeah,
made that comment.
Jeremy made the comment. And Microsoft, they make their bread and butter in the enterprise. And I think maybe they got caught up a bit too much in saying we want the rest. We want that 7%, that 5%.
But that's the sexy part, right?
Yes,
the consumers are the sexy part, and I think they want a bit of that, and that's why they're going, you know, becoming a bit more mainstream in the way they put out their, you know, their products and in terms of how they publicize them. I definitely think there's appeal to that to them.
Well, and keep in mind, of course, that whether it's a pretty niche or not, what you want to do for your business to thrive and survive as a brand, you need to own exactly one niche and completely dominate it. And whether they like the fact that that they're the nerdy guy with glasses, essentially, you know, the character from the Mac ads, that's who Microsoft is, and that's where they make their money. And I think you're right. I think there's this perverse desire for them to want to go toe-to-toe and to show the Apple that they can play their hip, stylish, cool game. And essentially, it muddies the water. It puts them in the mushy middle to where you don't know exactly what you're getting from it. It's like that when I think Windows 8, I think of one thing. I think of tiles, and I cannot name to you a single other benefit to the operating system.
Right. Well, I mean, a lot of it is behind the scenes. One of the big things about Windows 8...
But it shouldn't be behind the scenes. That's my whole point. They give me something besides tiles to get motivated about.
There's a killer Mahjong game.
Yeah.
More tiles. Always with the tiles, you.
I think that little girl who likes painting pictures with her fingers and printing it out for her dad, that seems like it's working really well for her.
This is terrible. What they should do is they should say, we're Microsoft, we're about making money and getting your business done, not about being pretty, stylish, hip, or cool. And yet that's what all of their marketing and advertising is saying. So it doesn't surprise me that
I want to throw this to Shira because I want the trending idea on this. Microsoft is, I mean, at their core, they are an enterprise company. They're all about being the business company. But I think they've been scared by the phenomenon of BYOD, bring your own device. You've got all these business people, these execs, and even, you know, mid-level managers who are bringing in their devices from home, their iPhones, their iPads, their MacBooks. And I think Microsoft freaked out. And so that's what Windows 8 is in response to.
But the thing is, I think you have to realize, like, while you're saying, they need to stay with what they're known for and how we all knew them, I don't think that's the right way to approach business. It's like the culture is changing. People are changing. Like you said, like companies used to buy computers en masse. Like they would just buy a ton of computers or laptops for their company and just, you know, give them off to different people and they would keep those computers at the office. But like what you said, like people are bringing their devices, what they like working with, from home. So the culture is changing. And so they need to change with the culture too if they want to be creating something that's relevant, which in turn drives revenue. I mean, I don't think it's about staying in the same model, but it's about, you know, creating something with that shift that works for them and not trying to just go after what they think everyone you know, wants based on another company's success. I think it's just about finding their own identity with that pivot. But it's not about staying the same. Like, no company has succeeded in staying the same as they always were.
Well, and I don't think it's necessarily a matter of staying the same, but certainly recognizing your core competency and, more importantly, what your brand is exceptionally valued for, and then going and targeting that like a laser. And instead, you know,
But it's never, it's not like Microsoft was never a consumer brand, the people that consumers had a relationship with, you know, before Apple's resurgence in the late 90s, you know, Windows was a, their, you know, people liked their Windows operating system because it added functionality that they didn't have before. You know, it was a big thing to the masses. So, I mean, like, and in that sense, they were far hipper then than they are now. I mean, Apple became a much sexier company, but it's not like they weren't a consumer brand.
I want to evolve the story a little bit. So let me add in a little tidbit. So when sales figures, so sales of Windows machines, of PC machines, have been adjusted, people had previously thought that we'd continue to see growth until about 2014. Gartner just adjusted their sales figures to show that starting in 2012, extending to 2016, we're actually going to start to see the PC market shrink. Now, before there's any panic, you got to know that there's about, I think, almost 100 million tablets sold a year. There's about 355 million PCs sold a year. There's about 650 million smartphones sold a year.
So the PC figure is not including tablets, which I know has been an issue where some people count tablets as PCs and some people don't.
Right, right. So, I mean, you can play with the numbers. It's not that much of a doom and gloom scenario, but my question to the panel would be this. With the release of Windows 8, with the fact that we're still waiting to see whether or not it's really going to change the game with this cross-platform UI, what would you expect to see? What do you want to see out of Microsoft as we head into this, again, post-PC era, which we've been promising since 1994?
I mean, it's I don't know necessarily what I expect. I mean, it's hard for me to even really want to chime in on this until we get don't feel like we've seen the main act on the Surface yet. I feel like until we have a full version of Windows running on a Surface tablet, that's when we're going to start to see the opportunity, because I think there's a lot of people who regard a lot of value to their iPads in enterprise, but they regard them mainly as toys, because you're not going to sit down, you're not going to work with Excel, you're not going to do anything in Apple numbers or whatever in there. It's not a grown-up enterprise object yet, but the Surface does have that opportunity to completely replace the functionality of most of these Road Warriors laptops. And I think that that's when we should start really judging whether or not this is the right call for them to make.
Yeah, that's interesting. I find that interesting is, you know, if we start looking at the iPad as the toy, right, what we use in our, you know, in our own time. You want to be able to use a gadget in all times. But if we look at this service as something that's for the professionals, and they use what they brought to professionals back in the day with the PC, and they translate that to the Surface, that could create a huge market. And also how you use the Surface in conjunction with all your other Microsoft gadgets, and then also, you know, maybe how it incorporates Bing and all their other products. I think that there could be huge value in that.
So I like this. I think I like what Brian said, that we've yet to see the main act here. I think the departure of Sanofsky delineates the beginning of a new era for Microsoft. Now, whether or not they can make something out of it, let's find out. Now, one person who doesn't need to find out anything about anything.
No.
Is none whatsoever.
He's done.
He's done with it. He knows
finding
everything.
Finding things, yeah.
And we want to talk to him right now. I think he's got some wisdom he wants to drop on us. Leo, what's going on?
Leo.
Excuse me, just a moment. I know this is a serious program, and I'm here to talk about a serious problem. It's if you're in the IT business, you got a serious problem, let me tell you. That is not a fun job. I understand. People are moving all over the place. You want to go somewhere. You're tied down. I have a way that can make your life so much easier. You can be more effective. If you want to make more money, you can. If you want to work less, you can. You get the choice. This is GoToAssist, and it is simply the most important tool for any IT or support professional. It is so awesome. Wait a minute. You say, I know about GoToAssist. It's remote access, right? Oh, well, it's, yeah, sort of. Much more than that. It is, in fact, the number one remote access, remote support tool used by more people than anybody else because of its speed, but also you can do 8 sessions at once. You can do unattended sessions. It's got a lot of features for IT professionals. But that's just scratching the surface. Remote support is just part of what GoToAssist does. The good folks at Citrix keep adding features. I guess that's why people are sometimes confused about what you get with GoToAssist. Sure, there's remote support. Live support for PCs, Macs, and mobile devices from PCs, Macs, and mobile devices. But you can also use their new service desk functionality to easily manage, track, and resolve issues. You can build a beautiful branded self-service portal. The service desk is amazing. And they've also added monitoring. I got to tell you, this is an incredible value. If you're an IT guy and you want to build your business, you become a managed service provider, for instance. That's what our friend Russell does, Russell Tammany. He's got 3 guys. They handle 350-plus clients. And the way they get it done is this. So here's how it works. GoToAssist, you put the crawler on the network, on your client's network. It tells you every bit of hardware and software, network devices, too, attached to the network, everything. Then you can track its performance. This is really important to being effective in IT, is kind of tracking how things, you know, what's going on. It's this dashboard. You can use standard modules or create your own customized ones. Keep track of everything. Plus, you'll get instant message, text messages, or emails when there's something, you know, that crosses a threshold, lets you know so you can immediately fix it. Be proactive in support. Nip a problem in the bud before it becomes a big one. Then the remote support's very handy too, right? I think you're going to love this. I want you to try. If you're in support, you got to try this. GoToAssist.com. GoToAssist.com. Click the try it free button right there and use our promo code TWIT. You get 30 days free. And by the way, you can try all 3 modules for 30 days free. So do check those boxes. You know, they say you want remote support? Yes. You want monitoring? Yes. You want service desk? Yes. And make sure, though, right there where it says promo code, you put TWIT so that we get credit for it. I love this. It's a great solution. You're going to love it, too. GoToAssist.com. This is serious stuff. I'm serious here. GoToAssist.com. Please use our promo code TWIT. And now, back to TWIT.
Thanks, Leo. We appreciate that. I do want to move on to the next story, and that is about, Zynga. Y'all remember Zynga. That's right. It's that gaming company that made its name because they basically tied themselves to Facebook. They IPO'd for $10. They're now down about $2. They just lost their CFO.
Man, $2
down,
or down?
Down to $2.
Yes.
Two. Lots of twos there.
Yeah.
And, their earnings are between 0 and 1 cent per share on sales of $300 million for the quarter. So they're not doing well. They lost their CFO, who has been with them since the beginning. And ironically, they lost him to Facebook. So they've lost about 78% of their value since the IPO. Zynga plans to cut its workforce by 5%. They closed its Boston studio. They're thinking about closing their offices in the UK and Japan. And they're taking a 50% write down on their $183 million purchase of OMG Pop.
Now, part of that was stock, though, right?
Part of that was stock, right. Yeah. So, it's not pure cash.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, that's horrible for a company that just bought what at the time people were thinking was a crazy, crazy overpriced purchase.
Well, especially since they could have waited 7 days. They could have actually just taken a long lunch and paid about half of what they did for OMG Pop.
Right. But there is something here, which is, I think someone in the chat room mentioned this during an episode of Twiet, which is, can you build a company that is founded on the idea of spamming your friends and family?
I mean, they certainly did. Whether or not they will be able to continue to will be what we will see. But,
Now, hold on. This is something Justin and I were actually talking about earlier today, as a matter of fact. And there is, hold out for this possibility, because Justin kind of blew my mind. There could be a single switch that gets flipped, and all of a sudden Zynga becomes the most profitable, the most important gaming entity in all of PC and the social media world. Can you say, I heard
and this is so secondhand, but the rumor was that Zynga is kind of holding out hope that their knight in shining armor is going to be some kind of either they find a loophole so they're able to do it, or a legal change in online gambling, that they are perfectly positioned for gaming online, especially if real money can be involved and they can get into what, you know, Poker Stars and sites like that were, that based, you know, in Facebook, they are perfectly nested to do that. Now, whether or not that happens, whether or not they can open up those functionalities in countries like the UK where these things are closer to legalization, or whether or not we see the culture change politically here where that is more likely, remains to be seen, but that seems to be what they would be perfectly positioned for.
Well, yeah, this goes back to companies that base their whole success and revenue off of, you know, off of Facebook, or you could say all the companies that were based off of Twitter also, that once they constrain those APIs and once they make it more restrictive and they don't let the floodgates open for traffic or for discovery, then all these companies find that they're not succeeding at all, and then they're not driving any sort of traffic. I mean, I don't think that, obviously Zynga used to spam everyone. I don't think it happens as much because Facebook probably created some regulations, rules around that. And the same thing goes for some of these video platforms that were coming up a lot, like, you know, whether it be the Viddies or the Touts or the one that Justin TV recently sold, I forget what it's called, but a lot of people were saying, oh, like they felt spammy because they were popping up in feed. And then suddenly Facebook restricted that and all of them saw a decline in users and in social, you could say, around the product. And so with Zynga, I mean, it's one of those things that it had its hot moments and people obviously still use Farmville and all these things. I mean, I was never really into that.
You're never a farmer, Shira?
I believe in the earth and in nature, but yes, you got me there. but I was never into it, but it's also that they never really changed. They never really added features or games. It's kind of like a lot of these companies have their big year and then they don't really evolve or innovate after that. It's kind of like they expect that that's it. This is the thing and everyone's loving it. And so I find they don't end up innovating or evolving at all. And I think that's what happened with Zynga, and also the draw something thing. I mean, I know Charles Foreman, he's awesome. But you know, yeah, if they had waited a week, it was literally 10 days later that draw something like lost all of its users and there was a huge decline. But it goes back to, we're always trying to find these hot companies this day and age, and we want to find the next Facebooks and the next Twitters. And we do believe as entrepreneurs that that is possible. There needs to be some sort of competition. However, these types of companies, you know, these types of things happen once every, you could say, decade. You know, it's like an Apple or Microsoft, like very few companies ended up pushing through, right? And I'm sure there are other little computing companies, but I think we're trying to do that in the social world as well. And obviously building our companies on top of these huge social networks, but it's hard to push through when you're on top of someone else's. You're like basically creating a party room in someone else's house.
No, we want innovation. We want them to evolve. But here's the problem I see, and that is Zynga doesn't have that in their DNA. I mean, we're talking about a company that has essentially made millions on making, making bad copies of other games.
I mean, you can say, I mean, bad subjective. And I mean, I think it would be harsh to say that their entire roster is just, you know, a borrowed product. But, you know, they certainly have gotten a reputation for it, you know, around the industry. That's what they are known for.
Yeah, if they were smart, they would have hooked up with like an EA Games. The problem is there's a lot of politics between the Zynga types, which created very simple type of games that were going up against these amazing, you know, huge franchises.
Intricate.
Yeah. And so I think if they had played nice a bit, EA, all these gaming companies who are driving millions of dollars and constantly are creating better and better products, they would have said, okay, let's come together and collaborate. But that collaboration never happened. And so you have like the Facebook gaming world, and then you have the real gaming world. And like, will we ever see the, the convergence of those two worlds? I think that's the interesting thing, which hasn't happened.
Well, not too long ago, people were saying that the Facebook gaming world, the Zynga gaming world, was going to take over because people wanted the Farmville. They wanted the little game they could play for 30 seconds every couple of minutes, and that consoles were dead and PC gaming was dead because, you know, only serious gamers actually went there. What we're seeing with this is, you know, you can only go so far selling virtual goods. Now, maybe if you turned on the gambling feature and actually had real money in real skin in the game, that would change it. But this seems to, for me, this kind of validates that the business model that Zynga is built on, it's not of sound ground.
Well, I mean, but I mean, is it an indictment? Is Zynga's experience an indictment of the entire social Facebook gaming community? I mean, I don't know if it's fair to say that. And real quick, just to put an addendum on the gambling thing, almost more so than the legality of running stuff like that is your ability to be able to make sure that people from other places where it is not legal are not interacting with it. Because if it were just a legality issue, they'd be able to turn it on for the UK. They'd be able to turn it on for, you know, parts of Europe where not only is this legal, but also Facebook gaming is very, very popular. The question is, is it too easy for somebody in Idaho to, you know, go and spend their money like that? And now are you legally culpable, especially as a company that is based in the United States, for allowing that to happen?
I want to evolve the story a little bit, and I want to bring Brian into this.
Evolve it, Darwin.
I'm evolving. Here we go. It's like a Pokemon with a little power peanut. All right. So we've got, in the last 2 weeks, two huge titles that were released and one new console accessory. So we've got Halo 4, which did gangbusters. It went $220 million dollars in the first 24 hours. And it's the latest installment of the Halo saga, which is it's big for Microsoft because it's not just about games. The Halo 4 universe has games. It's got spin-offs. It's got books. It's got a fantastic short on YouTube right now called Forward Unto Dawn, which if you haven't watched it, you really should, because it sort of fleshes out the mythos of the Halo universe.
Yeah.
And they've got a potential movie in the making. I mean, it's something that people are actually invested into. So $220 million there. By the end of this first week, it'll be $300 million. And you've also got Activision, one of these companies that Zynga sort of poo-pooed. They released Call of Duty. They made $500 million on their first day.
$550, I believe.
$550. So together, these two companies in more or less 10 days made more that Zynga will make the entire year.
Yeah, in many ways, these stories are the exact inverse of the Zynga story. Because Zynga, you have something that's massively popular that over time, they seem to be trying to squeeze blood out of a stone here, and they're having increased trouble. By all rights, Halo 4 should be just more of the same, because you're moving from Bungie to a different studio. There was an arc for the first three Halo games that was pretty much completed. Halo 4 coming back just to get to the same characters and same everything seems like a really bad idea. But I think it's 343 Studios. Is that who it is?
Right.
By all accounts, has knocked it out of the park by adding a new dimension to the game. They're telling a new type of story. They're making Master Chief a more compelling character, and they're crushing it from a financial point of view. There was I saw some retweet of somebody who was on a bus, and somebody asked, you know, oh, video games, have they had their Citizen Kane moment yet? And the guy responded by saying, I don't know, has movies had their Tetris moment yet? It's like video games, when you think in terms of dollar per dollar, I would be shocked if there ever was a Halo movie, because there doesn't need to be. Halo the game is what it is. And we understand that older generations think in terms of like, oh, now this is a legitimate, I'm using air quotes for the audio listener, a legitimate IP, and now it could get a legitimate form of entertainment with a movie. I think that it wouldn't even be worth it. It would be a waste of time and actually diminish the brand. Video games are what video games are, and that's the end of it. And it's in the finances speak clearly. We're playing our goofy movie draft on NSFW and frame rate. $500 million overnight makes the stakes that we're playing for in movies look like chump change, looks idiotic in comparison.
I mean, yeah, the video game industry, no doubt, is making a ton more money than the movie and TV industry. And if any of these games became a movie, it becomes just like a marketing play, right?
Sure.
They could be good movies.
And essentially, that's what they've done. That's what they've done with the Halo. As a matter of fact, if you, I think it's on the Machinima channel.
Machinima, actually. We had on What's Trending all the cast, and we work a lot with Machinima in terms of having a lot of the gamers and the people that are doing these scripted shows based on these games on our show to talk about it. And yeah, it's amazing. I mean, what Machinima has done on YouTube and with the gaming industry is just incredible. There's the video right now as everyone is watching it on Machinima Prime. But I just think, yeah, it is funny. I think we've underestimated the gaming community. And the fact that 5 years ago, probably, or maybe three, we thought that a company like Zynga would tear apart these types of games, which are so complex and detailed and beautiful. I think it underestimated the community in general and users, and thinking that they would want something so simple, buying products and working with the visuals that is a Farmville versus something that's like a crazy interactive experience. I think it's proven that people that are using these games and are the gamers are much more sophisticated than the creators thought. And I think that's an amazing thing. When you realize that communities are sophisticated, it raises the bar of the creators and the companies creating this.
I want to go back to one of the points that both Shira and Brian made, and that is, you know, a movie would be a fraction of the profit that they make off the video game. But it's fan service. And that's one of the things that this adds that Zynga will never have. And that is, you've got a community that is actually invested in the story. It was the same thing with Mass Effect. It's people who have actually played all the games who came back to finish the story. There is no story in Farmville. There's no story in a gambling game. And so I think that
doesn't mean, though, that there's not valuable IP.
No,
and that
you can't, and that you can't, a different type of user.
Yeah, and that you can't, I mean, like, you know, there's no plot to Angry Birds. It doesn't mean that there can't be an Angry Birds children's cartoon that will make a kajillion dollars.
That's actually a great example of a company, Angry Birds. Very, you know, very simple in terms of concept. It wasn't that complicated in terms of the animation, but yet it is a company that used that brand and they really did something with it and they had fun with it. They didn't take themselves too seriously and they continue to evolve it as well, you know, partnering with movies, with even, I think, nonprofits. I mean, and they're continuing to have people use it. And people, they're not really invested in it like a story. It's not like we're playing the characters and being like, oh, I'm the pig.
Why have they stolen the eggs yet again?
I'll tell you what, if you want a testament to how strong, and you always see this, whenever there's an emerging new art form, nobody knows what it is, nobody knows what the value is, and people have a tendency to discount it right off the bat. And I think we're seeing the last vestiges of that. Of course, you know, the social proof of how much money these video games are making is a big testament to it. But another part of it is Call of Duty shipped with the Call of Duty Black Ops 2 shipped with the ability to flip a switch and instantly live stream your gameplay over on YouTube. And we were talking about this before the show. Machinima was first to realize that people love watching other people play video games. And if there's, to me, that is a remarkable facet of this whole puzzle, is that there's something about the interactive narrative to where you don't even need to be playing the game yourself to get that experience. Your mirror neurons will fire watching somebody else noodle through stuff. For example, as soon as we're done here, I'm playing through the Walking Dead series, and you know, we'll get hundreds of people to tune in just to watch me make the agonizing decisions that you have to make in that game. I think that gaming is obviously financially matured at this point, where all of a sudden the Call of Duty franchise, I believe, is bigger than the Star Wars franchise, dollar for dollar, this point. I'm almost certain of it
merchandising might be, that might be.
Yeah, no, I don't know about merchandising, but I definitely saw that somewhere. We can look it up and somebody will tell me I'm wrong.
But But, that's really interesting, that whole culture of, and sorry, I totally interrupted you.
No. That's what we do. That's what we do. Don't worry about it.
No, but I was agreeing with you. I like loved that point you made, how now they're allowing people to stream it and like they're realizing the power of the social network is the user. It's the fan. It's the community. It's not necessarily the platform, right? You know, the game in itself, like having people share it, that's the word of mouth. That's the domino effect. And the fact is, it becomes like a choose your own adventure itself. It becomes like a movie. This is a next generation movie, these games, because every time you watch a different person play it, you know, that person, they are a star for this community, like whatever gamer that's a star in Machinima playing it, giving their commentary. But then every time you watch it, you see and discover something different. So it's like watching a movie probably 100 times, and every time you watch it, you're discovering something new. And that's really cool.
Well, I recently had a conversation with somebody who works at a major video game company that has a couple of very big franchises. And the point that they made, and they were very, very adamant about, is they don't want to be looked at as a company that makes video games. They want to be looked at in beyond the context of interactive gaming and in the larger context of entertainment. You know, they don't want to. What was that?
It's storytelling.
Yeah, absolutely. And but specifically in that point of view, then you're not looking at this necessarily saying like, well, you know, video games are it and movies are not happening. They want it all. They want to have the head start to say like, all right, well, listen, just because we have a very, very valuable intellectual property that people have invested themselves in and invested hours in and want to see continued evolution of these people in interesting, you know, different narratives. So, you know, they just want to say, like, if Disney makes the Avengers and they have a crappy video game tie-in, they want to just go the other way and say, listen, we have a successful video game franchise and we also want to have an amazing action movie, you know, series, and we want to do something like that. In the same way that now you're looking at, you know, what Disney bought Star Wars, and now Disney wants to do 3 Star Wars films a year, not necessarily all following like the Luke Skywalker story, but just using that universe to make entertainment that people want to buy. So
I'll tell you what, man, think about it this way. Not only is it remarkable the level of success that video games have on launch and how valuable these properties have become, but this is also a polarized type of entertainment. You don't run into a lot of people who say, what's this? What's a Star Wars? A movie? Oh, no, I don't do movies. Nobody says that. Movies are universally beloved and everyone does them, whereas you do get that with video games. And so as this generation ages and starts to push out the communities that just, you know, games are just this thing somebody else does, I think the numbers are only going to get bigger and these immersive world and properties are only going to become more valuable and more legitimized. I mean, I'll say this much. The experience of playing through all 3 Mass Effect games was as rich and as detailed as any novel I've read and as any movie trilogy I've ever watched. And I think that you're going to have this sea change as more and more people recognize the artistic legitimacy of video games.
Now, let me ask you this. I mean, I like the engagement factor. I like content. I like something like the Halo 4 backstory or the Mass Effect backstory or even the Call of Duty backstory that they've tried to create. But the people who would enjoy something like that, are those the same people who want the no backstory, just sort of distraction gaming of Zynga?
Well, in the same way that there are movies for all different kinds of people, there are video games for all different kinds of people. There's books for all different kinds of people. You know, you want to sit down and immerse yourself in something like Halo. You want to fart off a little bit on Facebook and play a little Farmville. You know, like it's different strokes for different folks, as a wise man once said.
Well, speaking of different strokes, Brian, where does the Wii U fall in there?
Yeah, no, this is interesting to watch the launch of the Wii U. Of course, when the Wii came out a few years ago, Wii was synonymous with unavailable, with sold out. But the Wii U, at this point, Nintendo tends to be really smart and savvy with their launches, and I'm not seeing it this go around. The announcements built up a tremendous amount of hype when they said that their TV service was essentially going to be like the ultimate set-top box that would allow you to access all of your cable programming in a awesome interface, and you'd be able to, you know, use Amazon Instant, Netflix, Hulu, and all those. And of course, it was announced that was delayed until December. And on top of that, when you get this thing home, you have to sit for a 5 gigabyte firmware update before you can even use the dang thing. I don't know. It's I don't want to call it a misstep just yet, but man, this is not the launch of the Wii U that I had expected.
The chat room is calling it a fail whale.
I mean, you know, there are some fairly gaudy numbers. I mean, there was a report that 3.5 million units will be sold by 2012. I mean, it's not, I mean, granted, and this is something I just want to say to all of this discussion, as much as we want to talk about the big numbers that are being reported by Halo and Call of Duty, we don't exactly know what that means to the profit bottom line. We don't know, I mean, the difference in developing a game and, let's say, developing a movie, if we're going to go apples to apples on those comparisons, are two completely different things with two completely different bills at the end of it. So, you know, I don't know. I don't exactly know what 3.5 million units means for the Wii U, nor do I really know whether 500 million in one day for Call of Duty is, I mean, it sounds like a big successful number, but we don't know exactly how much it costs to make.
Brian, how does it compare? I'd be interested to know how it compares to, like, other units. Like, if 3.5 million by the end of 2012, is that reasonable? Is that looked at as successful?
You know, I'm not going to be in the business of telling them whether they are or aren't a success, but I will say that
it beat the original Wii's holiday launch. That's what IHS.
This is the console game. And in the console game, it's not necessarily about selling the consoles, because you will sell the maximum number of consoles eventually. It has always been about the attach rate. And the Wii has always lagged behind the Xbox and even now the PS3 in attach rate. So it doesn't matter if you're selling 20 million Wii Us if they're only buying one or two games each.
Yes.
There's so many little missteps that drive me nuts. For example, the fact that the Wii U can't play, it will not upscale existing Wii video games, which is something the Dolphin emulator is already able to do. You can play the Wii games on your PC using the Dolphin emulator, and it'll upscale it to the highest resolution. As a matter of fact, my assistant John Tilton was saying that on his MacBook with Retina display, it's utterly gorgeous, and it was confounding to him that now John is about the biggest Nintendo fanboy I've ever encountered, but he's so annoyed that he says he's going to hold off on the Wii U purchase.
What's the bee in his bonnet specifically?
I mean, just it's all these little missteps, and the fact that there's not a compelling game, the fact that the new Super Mario Brothers is a retread, it's not that Wii Sports moment where it's like you played the bowling once and you're like, I gotta have this, I'll do whatever it takes to do it. Instead, there's a bunch of minor annoyances, everything from the sparse memory that comes with it to the in some cases they used cheaper inferior parts for the speed of the memory. The fact that they're promising all of these partnerships that haven't come out yet with the TV service, the fact that the fact that it won't upscale old content. Again, all of this is just very un-Nintendo, and I think we've seen a number of missteps continuing back with the 3DS launch and so on.
I think we've come full circle with the Wii, with Nintendo, because you remember when they released the Wii, people smashed it because it didn't compare to the next generation consoles.
To the PS3 and the Xbox.
PS3 and the Xbox. But then it started selling like hotcakes because, oh, well, it's getting the non-gamers. People who don't normally game were picking up the Wii controllers and doing the sports game or the tennis game. But the story that wasn't being told was that's the only thing that they did. They bought the Wii with the included game, and then it either sat in a closet or underneath an entertainment center.
These are people that aren't the loyal gamers. You're saying, like, that's great for a one-off success. It's like having a one-night stand. Like, okay, it's great for your ego.
Wait, what's that?
But it's not.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah,
you learn one new thing every day.
Yes.
So it's like, you know, they had that like one hit of success with the non-gamers, which is great when you appeal to that broad audience. A lot of brands have huge success off that and build their company off that. However, I think with gaming, and listen, I'm not a huge gamer, and I'll be honest about that. But with gaming, it seems like it's not about having just the non-gamers play once in a blue moon. It's about having those people that are like super obsessed, loyal gamers and users. And that's where you really build your business and your credibility in the gaming world.
Well, and remember, the era when the Nintendo Wii came out is pre-iPhone.
Yeah, that's a long time ago.
The Facebook gaming that we're talking about with Zynga. There's a lot of competition for the non-gamer gamer time right now.
It almost felt like they came out, they did a big splash, and then they were quiet for a few years while everyone else kind of came in on their territory. And then they're coming back really with not that many changes. And so people really don't care anymore, right?
Yeah. Well... Yeah.
Sorry, I was trying to look for when the Wii actually came out to make sure I wasn't lying.
I think the frustrating thing is that the Wii U holds so much promise. I think that they are positioned to do the second screen experience right. They are positioned to be that that all-encompassing entertainment console that it goes beyond the video games that you play. And instead, you know, it also is how you surf the web. It's also... how you watch your television. And
yeah.
I think, I got totally swept up. We talked about this on frame rate. I went from zero interest in a Wii U to 100% interest in a Wii U, because if I could get a Wii U and have it do the things that that I would expect from a Google TV instead, and do it with a polished, you know, Apple-like kind of interface where they secure the deals and they take me out of the miserable Time Warner DVR experience, then I for that alone, I would totally buy it.
See, and like, realistically, you're the nerd. You're the kind of like the nerd, the person that knows about all this stuff.
Nerd,
sure.
But nerd in an awesome way. I love, when I use the word nerd, it's like an amazing thing.
Don't you
it's
ever like, apologize for using the N-word. That's our
yes,
word.
That's our nerd. Word now. We've reclaimed it.
But, like, I feel like regular people who want to have that interactive second screen experience to use internet or TV, they're either, the Google TV, the Xbox, even now there's, like, the Vizio TVs and the Samsung TVs. They're not getting the Wii U for that. I think they associate Wii with gaming. They don't associate it with using it for other reasons.
But the one thing that the Wii set-top box element had that no one's really been able to crack is the idea of, and Google TV attempted to do this, that it's not only just the place where you can access Netflix and Hulu Plus and stuff like that, but it's also the feeder. It is the filter for your television signal, you know, for your cable, for your satellite, and to add a actual functional user interface on these services that we interact with so much. I think there is a great benefit to that if you can do it right. But is it enough for people to buy a Wii U, especially in this era when it's like, you see those commercials and you see the big, stupid, clunky controller and you're looking down at things and flicking them onto the television. And it's like, really? Like, is that where we're at in an era when we have this kind of processing power on iPhones and iPads and people are already doing stuff on sleeker devices that they can take anywhere? Like, is that where we're going?
Okay, so I think the takeaway from this is if we look at Zynga, if we look at Halo, if we look at Call of Duty, if we look at the Wii U, we have to say that everyone listening to this broadcast right now needs to watch Brian play Walking Dead tonight.
Absolutely. It'll be more interesting than the actual show.
That's our takeaway. Speaking of takeaways, I've got Leo waving at me like a madman from the office, so let's find out what he wants.
What an interesting thing for Leo to have you run the show while he's just right over there in his office.
He's actually, it's quarantine.
He's made it.
It's like the movie Outbreak. He can't be let out.
So, Leo, what can we do for you?
Hello, everybody. This is the portion of Twit where John C. Dvorak usually gets up and searches for stuff to steal. Stealing is such a harsh word. To borrow from the Twit brick house. I mean, he's inevitably, after the commercial, John will sit down and say, you need that? You want that? You're going to use that? Can I take this? He has taken microphones. He has taken steaks. He has taken bottles of vinegar. I think it's just part of the deal is that John gets one thing every show. One thing he gets to take with him during every show. So, John, be my guest. Wander about. I'm going to talk a little bit about Ford right now. Our show brought to you, as always, by the Ford Motor Company. I love my Ford Mustang. Can I buy, I'm asking Lisa, can I buy the Fusion, the 2013 Fusion Energy? Can I buy that? That's... You can have the Mustang. You need a bright red muscle car. She wants the new Mustang. You see, we're a Ford company. We love Fords. As long as it's got that sink built into it, I'll take any Ford. And I have to say, one of the nice things about Ford now is all 2012 and later model Fords sold in the U.S. have sink available. So there's no reason not to get Sync in your Ford, your next Ford. I got it's fantastic. What is Sync? Well, you can go to Ford.com/technology and find out more about Sync. What it does and what I really like about it is it keeps your attention. This is it, by the way. Just, Lisa, you're paying attention. That's the one I want, the Ford Fusion 2013. It's a plug-in hybrid. Oh, I didn't put it up on the screen. There it is. This is the car. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. We'll figure it out. Bright red, so it'll match the Mustang. How about that? And I'll keep the twit plates. If you go here, you can explore the Sync commands. The idea is you talk to your car for everything. Climate temperature, 70 degrees. Play artist Grant Moorman. You call mom, call school, call office. What's the traffic like? My destination is nightlife. Take me there. I'm hungry. I'm not kidding. You can tell Ford Sync, I'm hungry. And it will provide a list of nearby restaurants. You can also say, find a pizza parlor, and it will find you. I love that. The things this can do. Now, of course, it's really great for keeping in touch with your entertainment. You can browse your music collection by genre, by album, by artist, by playlist, by song. You can voice-activated control your media player. It'll even play a list of music you're in the mood for. You could say, play similar music, for instance. And it'll play similar music to the song you're listening to right now. No matter how your music is stored on your smartphone via Bluetooth streaming on a USB drive, you can actually load a USB drive up with music and listen that way. Of course, the iPad, the iPod works great with an iPhone 5. You could say, read me my text messages, call my voicemail, reply to a text message, browse all audiobooks. Available Sync with My Ford Touch and HD Radio lets you do iTunes tagging. You can tag a song as you listen to it on an HD radio station, transfer that info to your iPod, and purchase a song directly from iTunes when you get home. That is cool. That is so cool. Best of all, Sync is available on all new 2012, 2013 Ford vehicles sold in the U.S., so there's no reason not to have it. Here's what you do. Go to your Ford dealer and say, I want to test drive Ford Sync. Oh, and yeah, throw a car in. I like that Fusion, but the new Focus, that's nice too. Ford.com/technology to learn more. Go further in a Ford. Now, if with any luck, John hasn't gone too much further, and we can continue with Twit.
Thanks,
and that's
Leo.
So weird.
Thank you.
That's so weird because John's not even here. I mean, because Leo's just right over there. It just seems like he would notice that.
Yeah, but you know, see, Leo is he's a man of mystery. He's an enigma wrapped in a pretzel. I'm not sure what that means. But, you know, something else Leo wanted to remind me of is the fact that, Brian, you know this. We have more than one show on the Twit Network. Did you know that?
No. Yeah, is that for reals?
It's for realsies, not just for funds.
No. Wow.
Yeah.
If only we could see what goes on the other parts of the Twit Network.
You know what? We may be able to help you with that. Chad, what can we show the folks about the Twit Network?
Previously on Twit. Security Now.
Microsoft is proactively notifying Skype users who may have had this happen to them. So if you don't get email from Microsoft, then you're okay.
Home theater geeks.
But if you're wearing headphones, every time you turn your head, the sound moves with your head, which is not the way the real world or the world of speakers works. And if you're watching, if you're working with sound with picture, like if you're watching a movie, you certainly want the dialogue to stay on the screen and the surround stuff to be behind you and so on.
All about Android.
Uh-oh. What happened?
Did you just...
So we've been...
Android 4.2 coming to my phone. Oh, sorry. Here he comes.
Yeah, there it is.
But
the question is, do you do it on the show? Oh, no, never mind. You did it.
I just hit check now.
It's a reflex, really. When you see update to 4.2, you just go.
Gizwiz.
Don't let it be Chad.
Well, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but yeah, I got Chad for today.
Oh, is he there yet?
I don't know. He said he was going to help out, but...
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, yeah. I can't believe
I cannot believe it. I was taking a nap.
He did say... He said yes. He's doing it, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm excited.
My favorite co-host.
Twit. Test drive one today.
It's So basically what you see is that we're trying to, in 2 weeks, destroy the house that Leo built. That's awesome. That's fantastic.
He'll come home from Australia to smoldering ruins.
A big smoking crater.
The pillar of smoke from Petaluma will be nothing but the ashes of Twit.
You know what else goes well with ashes?
When Twit is in ashes, you have my permission to unsubscribe.
Yeah. Well, we're talking fiber now. Specifically, we're talking Google Fiber.
Yeah.
How much have you guys heard about this? I mean, you know that Google Fiber was announced a while back. They had these fantastic plans.
I want all those fine citizens of Kansas City just rubbing in my face even more. How fast is it? Oh, your downloads are that good?
That's right.
Your cable service is that much better now? Please, do tell me more. I need that sarcastic Wonka picture.
Well, here it comes right at you. The fastest you can get from Comcast right now is about 305 megabits per second, and that's if you live in a very specific area right next to one of their offices. And I think that plan costs something like $300. It's ridiculous. Wow. It's crazy. It's a lot of money. Google was offering a plan of $70 for 1 gig synchronous. That's 1 gig up, 1 gig down. You did have to pay a $300 installation fee, but they also had a $120 plan that included the 1 gig up, the 1 gig down, and HDTV, which would price it way below slower offerings of Comcast's Infinity or Nextfinity or whatever they call that thing. They also had the Megafinity. R.L. Stein. And they also had a plan where you could just pay the $300 installation fee one time, and you would have 5 megs down, 1 meg up for life. Never another
freezies.
Fee.
For freezies.
For freezies, yeah. Just because they were being nice. Well, Google lit it up. It is now active. If you ordered Google Fiber to your house, you are now getting it. And it's fantastic because it's creating a brand new market in Kansas City. The story I found was about a man named Mike Demiris. I'm horrible with names. But basically, he bought, for $48,000, he bought a home in Kansas City, and he's turning it into sort of a vacation for people who want a broadband and a place for startups to congregate. They're talking about how the addition of Google Fiber to Kansas City could now possibly turn it into an internet hub. Now, this has been an idea that's been bouncing around a lot of enterprise geeks' heads for a while, and that is, if you put high-speed internet in the middle of a cornfield, you could recreate the Silicon Valley. What do you think about that? What's anyone's take on that?
Dude, I'll tell you what, man. There's no doubt this is one of the most awesomely disruptive things we've ever seen Google do. And if there was ever a question of whether or not your whole goal was to just stick a finger right in the eye of cable service, it's not just the fact that they're offering an infinitely superior service at an amazing price. But on top of that, if you look at the Google Fiber blog, they talk about the other little things they're doing. Stuff like they guarantee that the service people will show up at the on time. Like, they'll give you an hour long
window. Yes.
They'll show up at the beginning of that hour. What a crazy idea. And then they bring their own vacuums so that they can clean up the drywall that they put all over your carpet. It's almost as though they got roused out of bed and they came down and they're like, all right, you a-holes, you want to do this? This is how you do it right. It's called service. It's called superior quality product. Now we're out. We're Google.
Yeah.
Yeah. And which is easy, right? It's like, duh, just bring, you know, customer satisfaction and then more people are going to want to support you. It's not that difficult. However, it is definitely a hit to all the cable companies. And this is just an example, you know, of what's to come. And I do think it has to do a lot with it. It's going to go also back to possibly content, you know, the Comcast, Time Warners, those bundle deals. We're going to see, oh, what bundle deal can you get with the Google Fiber, with Google TV?
Yeah.
And the shows that come with that. And it's going to, you know, it's going to be that domino effect as well. I know someone that worked that was an exec at YouTube that actually ended up moving on to Google Fiber.
Hold on. I mean, this is amazing. And this is great. And like Brian said, disruptive is the key word. However, it's a lot easier. It's way easier for them to do this in one medium market than it is for, let's say, a Comcast or a Time Warner to spread this over, you know, the gigantic footprints that they have, no matter how awful they are. And believe you me, I think we can all agree that if we look at the pain that we feel as consumers, much of it is from these kind of companies. However, you know, what I love about this is that they are doing everything right. I hope they continue to spread out. I hope that this is not the only market that Kansas City just doesn't become Google Fiberville, and we don't see this in other places. And what I wish is that, you know, they took more disruptive kind of element like this in other super pain points, including there was a story this week about them maybe looking to do a wireless service to pair with Dish Network, but I'm afraid that that won't be as possible because of their relationship with these companies that they've had to make for Android and that Android relies upon. Because this is, I think, this is what, as a fan of Google, I love to see Google do, is take their big, gigantic wad of cash and roll into town like a happy feelings Johnny Appleseed and just toss smiles amongst the villagers.
Still at work in the chat room, he says that basically Google walked on stage, made their announcement, and then dropped the microphone. And that's pretty much, that's the kind of disruption here. I mean, it also includes 1 terabyte of Google cloud storage, and there are absolutely no caps. Now, this is supposed to be a dry run. Google is just testing, and the reason why they chose Kansas City is because it's near one of their big data centers. For them, since most of the traffic on the internet is a Google service, either Google Search or Google YouTube, Gmail, it really doesn't cost them anything to run the service over the pipes they already own. Like Brian said, I want to see what happens if this lands in Los Angeles. And suddenly, suddenly you've taken an entire market away from the traditional telcos.
And keep in mind also that there's an opportunity here for there's a fantastic book. I think it's called The Walmart Effect, talking about how Walmart not only vastly improved the supply chain for their goods, causing essentially an increase of standard of living of thousands of dollars for people nationwide, but more importantly, by virtue of figuring out and solving those supply chain things. That's because of Walmart, you no longer have to spend an extra nickel to 10 cents for packaging for deodorant. And that's not just at Walmart, that's at all stores. By virtue of eliminating, say, this is stupid, why are you wasting money on this packaging? Then all of a sudden everyone's like, yeah, no, that is stupid. Why are we wasting that money on packaging just to remain competitive? So what I'm hoping is that we get a Google effect, a halo, where because of even it is just in this one market, and yes, what they're doing right now probably is not scalable to the entire country. But again, it's that disruptive element. It's that opportunity to show people that, yes, you can give exceptional customer service and show up on time and provide everything at a reasonable price that hopefully we'll see improvements in other services.
Yeah. Hopefully that creates fear so that these other companies step it up a notch and say, you can't continue doing things the way you've been doing them because someone else is going to come in on your territory. And it's happening. It's obvious that Kansas is a case study that if it works and people hear of it, they'll ask for it in their cities as well. And people will fight for it. And when people step up, that's when, the floodgates will open.
But the question is this the a business that Google wants to be in, or is this like the self-driving car where it's more of a project than it is
a business? No, I think this creates more control. No, this creates more, wouldn't you think this creates more control, more people? If you're providing internet for everyone in a certain city, when that's, people would want to support the brand more. They would go to Google, their default browser, their default, you know, access to TVs or the content would be on Google, the Google screen, Google TV. They would go to YouTube. Doesn't it go into all the other areas of their business in the end?
I think so. I mean, I think it's to me, this kind of stuff is, like I said, exactly where I want Google to go into, because I think that their aims here are aligned with the customers. And in the same way that when they were initially thinking about bidding on the Open Spectrum auction a couple years ago, I thought that would have been a great place for them to get into. And I think, you know, in terms of the over-the-air stuff, I don't know if, their relationships that they've had to make for Android have not curtailed their ability to do stuff like this in, you know, another area where I think we would all be very happy for them to get into.
I was listening to a CEA talk in D.C. not too long ago, and it was interesting because there was a telco representative. I won't say which telco, but we'll just say that
Verizon. They're
really big and they have a lot of cables. We'll just leave it at that.
But the vision of these cables, amazing.
But one of the questions that they posed him was, well, what do you think about the Google Fiber? What do you think about the rollout in Kansas? And his response just sort of boggled my mind, because he was saying, well, we're seeing that Google is unfairly leveraging a competitive basis that they shouldn't have, that has been given to them unfairly because they're not regulated like a telco. And here okay. I'm thinking, wait a minute, the telcos for years and years and years have been saying if there was a cheaper way to do it, someone already would have done it. And that's been their reason for lagging behind on rollout of high-speed internet. Now that Google's doing it, they're sort of switching bases and they're saying, no, we need more regulation because you need to protect us from these new little players. It strikes me again that this is, as Brian referred to, is that disruptive force. They've been kicked in the teeth. And I think Google doesn't actually want to be the national ISP. They want more ISPs to be like what they rolled out in Kansas.
Will that happen, though, if they don't go further than Kansas, though? Or are they just going to be doing donuts in the one parking lot?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Why?
Just knowing a thing is possible is what it takes to make happen. There are examples, for example, in the juggling world, to use a stupid example, where if you want to throw, we'll say, you know, 12 rings or whatever, you know, nobody can juggle more than 12 rings at the same time. But then all it takes is one video of a person doing it. And then all of a sudden it's possible. And then all of a sudden in the next 2 weeks, 20 people now post a video of them juggling 12 rings or whatever. Simply by virtue of showing that it can be done, it does two things. First of all, it sets an expectation on the consumers, which is extraordinarily important because it gets them asking their local cable providers, why are you not providing X, Y, and Z? And number two, it lets those providers know that it's possible and that they could arrange their management in order to make it happen.
The problem is a lot of these contracts that these companies have are like 5 to 10 year contracts. The change and disruption can't necessarily happen from those traditional companies. And that's why a company like Google can do it. They can change things every month if they really want to. So that's the big problem that's happening right now with the other companies like the ISPs that you're talking about, is they're in packages that, you know, you're dealing with so many layers of politics in terms of people trying to keep their jobs, trying to keep things the way they have been because they're trying to control the value of something that maybe doesn't have the same value as it used to have. And so that disruption might not be able to happen in the next even 5 years in those companies because they need to get through the contracts that they've signed to keep things in order in what they think works, even though it doesn't work for the consumer where things are evolving.
Okay. And I understand that showing that it's possible is an important step. But like what Brian said earlier about the idea of retailers, changing how they distribute stuff, and then all of a sudden there's a ripple effect there. If Google is making money on this, then I think telcos will look at it and say, okay, well, it's possible that we can have huge sign-up rates and consumer happiness, and we can charge, you know, X amount for this kind of product. That's great. We'll make money off it. If they are not, and it's looked at as this is Google's hobby where they're just looking to stir the pot, but they are losing money on their fiber stuff, then I don't know if telcos look at that and say, well, yes, there's an opportunity that we could lose money and give people things.
You're right.
I don't think we're ever going to see a breakdown on Google's balance sheet.
You know, no.
Quarterly report.
We don't see that on YouTube.
Yeah, because they're not seeing this as they don't want to make money off the ISP. They just want to drive more people into Google services. And they're doing that in a big way. If they're giving you 1 terabyte of free storage, if they're giving you TV channels for just a tiny bit more over your broadband subscription, they're going to get more people using Google services. They're going to get a better bottom line. That's what they're going to show off.
They're looking at the long-term investment, right? I think the companies that always look at, oh, can we make money tomorrow, aren't necessarily the ones that succeed. It's about investing in the projects and the platforms of the future, which sometimes don't have revenue coming in the next day.
Right. Now, let me get even more disruptive. Jerry, he alluded to this story a little earlier. And that is, there's some rumblings, there's a few rumors that maybe Google wants to get into the mobile device business. They've been talking to Dish Networks about purchasing spectrum so that they could roll out their own nationwide network. Now, this is a fantastic story because it extends on what we were just speaking about with Google Fiber. Google has in the ground, privately owned, more fiber than any of the big telco players. They have the backhaul that Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile and AT&T wish they had. Now, this could just be one of these things where they only deploy where they have data centers. And again, because it's cheap for them. But what would having something like a fifth carrier charging $20 a month because they're not trying to make money on the service, but they're trying to make money on driving you to Google products, what would that do to the industry?
Dude, I'm very happy with my iOS ecosystem. I would drop all that in a heartbeat and become a total Android fanboy, boom, overnight, if they were to provide service.
Yeah, I think it's that disruptive.
Yeah, sorry,
Shira, go ahead.
No, if you think about it, a lot of the next generation people consuming content, they're doing it on their phones. Like 40% of our viewers are watching on mobile devices. And right now, though, it's hard to watch on mobile devices with other carriers. So yeah, if they controlled that as well, you would say a lot of the people, if they're getting, who knows, all their video on YouTube, and they know that they can even get now full out movies and it'll be really quick because the service is better, then why wouldn't you use that and go with them as well?
I would love for this to be available, and I'd be very curious to see what Google looks to do with it, because I think that there is an internal debate within Google on where they are best served, specifically when it comes to the mobile platform, that, you know, now we're going to see the release, and it'll be very telling this week or next week when they finally release the iOS, Maps app, which apparently is now close to coming out, on how good that is, because there's been obviously a great, you know, consternation in that company of what they wanted to give functionality wise to the iOS platform. And there were people inside Google that want to make it as good as possible. They want to have everybody possibly using Google services, because ultimately that is what makes them money. AdWords makes them money. That is their cash cow. And the more people that are, the more real estate they can have to show you AdWords, the better off they are. The debate is whether or not on mobile that is better served through going through everybody. So let's say if they had a wireless carrier, do you want iPhones on that? Do you want Windows 7 devices on that? So you can have more of a relationship with people, and you can know the data that they are sending, and you can track that and add that to your participation graph, for which, you know, is Google's lifeblood. Or do you restrict it only to Android phones and make it an incentive that, hey, if you buy the latest Google device, the latest Android phone, it comes on our awesome ISP, and now you'll be better than AT&T, Sprint, Verizon, whatever.
Let's take it to its awesome conclusion, and that is to say, look, we already know Android owns 75% of the market. So 3 out of every smartphones being bought today is an Android phone.
Yeah.
We know that the Nexus 4 sold out in 50 minutes or so? So it's a hot device. People want the latest and the greatest. They know that Android is now a mature mobile operating system. We know that Google has been bundling service with every single one of their products. So you buy, for example, they just released a brand new $200 Acer Chromebook with 100 gigabytes of Google Drive. So let's now say that they sell you an Android phone that also includes 2 years of service on Google's ISP and also includes 500 gigabytes of cloud storage space. Again, they're capturing people, they're bringing them in, and they're showing them why it's great to stay with Google. At what point should AT&T, Sprint, T-Mobile, and Verizon be pooping in their pants?
I think that they would be pooping in their pants, to use your inelegant
that's a technical
analogy.
Term, by the way. It is.
I think they would be doing more of that if it was switch your phone now. You know, if it was go on google.com/phone switch and you were able to sign on to their service no matter what your mobile carrier was. No matter what your phone is. I think that's where you see telecoms really, really, really start freaking out, because now that's disruption. That is showing, like what Brian said, we can have, the Google, kinds of offerings when it comes to, you know, no caps for what you are looking to use and stuff like that. That, to me, is the ultimate nightmare scenario for the telcos. If it was an Android phone exclusive kind of thing, I don't know. Because a lot of the reason why so many Android phones get pushed is because they are the favorite thing for these telcos to push out to their people. How well would Android do if all of a sudden Verizon, AT&T, and Sprint didn't have an incentive to push Android phones, and getting them into the Android ecosystem was now harmful to their business. I don't know.
Well, I'm sold. I'm an Android person. Android and Windows.
Okay. You just admitted you're a robot. We knew it.
You know what? I want to step back from Google a little bit and do something a bit more, well, let's call it social. And Brian, stop me if you've heard this before. Teenage kid.
Yes.
Post something on the internet. Post something on the internet. Later goes on to regret it. Familiar story? Timeless story? What are we doing?
This doesn't sound like any of us. I mean, anyone in the world.
That's right. This comes from Maryland. There's actually a blog that was created by just some guys with some extra time. They were getting tired of seeing racist tweets on Twitter. And we got to be careful with the story because I don't want to actually show the page because it gets pretty bad. People who were calling out Obama after his election win, and I'm not getting political. This could be anything. This is not just racist election tweets. This could be sexist tweets. This could be homophobic tweets. Whatever it might be, imagine that. Now imagine somebody has decided that the way he's going to call attention to this problem of people anonymously trolling the world is by posting their information along with their offensive tweets or Facebook posts to a blog. Now, he's not breaking the law. He's not hacking. He's only using publicly available information.
He's just putting them on blast, as we say in the
hip-hop community. He's acting like a troll too, to the trolls.
Right, he's trolling the trolls.
Trollception.
And so we have this. Yeah, falling back in slow motion. So he created a blog called Hello There Raceless. Racists. Yes, racelets.
I'm raceless.
Yes. A Tumblr. And he just started posting pictures of people who have made racist remarks about the president. It's created sort of an outrage because there are some people on one hand who are saying it's about time. These people should know that what they're saying is public. On the other hand, there are some other people who are saying, look, these are teenagers. These are young adults. They did something stupid, but you're pointing out the fact that what they wrote is going to live in infamy. There have been many of these Twitter accounts that have been deleted because people were ashamed of what they wrote. And there have been at least three people that I counted who lost their jobs because someone read the blog and realized they didn't want that person working.
They couldn't say something racist and have it be private. Whatever happened to America?
Freedom of speech.
Exactly. So, I mean, but is the question here whether or not this site is ethically okay?
Yeah, well, I mean, is it ethically okay? Is this a good thing?
I think it's okay to call people out saying you need to take responsibility for saying things that are completely derogatory, harassment online, cyberbullying. However, posting their addresses, isn't that an invasion of privacy of some sort?
Well, see, that's the thing. They would only post information that already existed. So they didn't hack anything.
Hacking, but you going out of your way to find that and bring it to people. I mean, you could say putting up my address. I'm sure it's available.
Let's stop that. Rewind.
All of us, something is available online that someone could reveal that we thought maybe couldn't be revealed or isn't there. I don't think that's necessarily right. I think it's okay maybe to call someone out and say this is their full name, but to say where they live, their address, their phone number, that's a bit harassment in itself.
Well, are they saying that? I think they're just taking the embed code from their Twitter, from like the Twitter's embed this tweet feature, and they're just saying that basically...
Let's say it is that. I mean, because I think the reason the Padre introduced this is because it's more of a philosophical question. I mean, is it a nice thing? Absolutely not. But even if it was somebody making hay out of targeting racists and he's got an agenda and holding these people accountable for what they say, is even if that's, you know, a bad or mean, terrible thing to do, I got to think that in general, anything that raises the awareness, especially for young people, that what they're saying is in public and on the record and they should act like it, is going to have a net benefit to society. I mean, it's still amazing to me how many things people say and do online as if there's no chance of it coming back to bite them. I mean, think about this. People, posting pictures or whatever, figuring that they're pretty much anonymous. What happens when 10 years from now, 20 years from now, facial recognition algorithms get good enough to where retroactively they can set robots loose on Flickr, on Twitter, on, you know, YFrog, all these image hosting services, and all of a sudden know exactly who every nameless face in every photo is at that point and piece everything together. I mean, this is coming, and I think this is another piece of the puzzle where people need to figure out that they're going to be held accountable for all of their behavior, whether or not they think anyone's watching.
Let's extend this, because there actually was a similar case not too long ago of a group that they posted addresses, pictures, phone numbers, all publicly available information of public servants that they disagreed with. And in that particular case, it was some Tea Party people who really did not agree with policies of some more liberal types of public servants, along with these people hate America. These people are trying to destroy America. And there was this, well, is that a threat? Are you putting these people up like a hit list? Are you asking someone to do something about it?
Yeah.
When does free speech and asking people to realize that they live in a public society cross the line into you're now trying to incite violence against someone?
Okay, well, let's be clear on exactly what is happening with this particular site.
Right.
Okay? What is happening with this particular site is that a big thing happens, like the election, mm-hmm. or just randomly. Let's say it's 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, and they type in the Twitter search function the N-word.
Right.
They find out how many people are using the N-word, and so in the river of the internet, they cast the N-word net into there, and then they pull out the fishes that are using this particular term. They then take the embed function and they put it on their blog, or they're people that retweet this kind of stuff. And that's the point, is that right now these people are saying this, or within the last however long it was, because it's obviously chronological in the search function. So that's what's happening. This is publicly searchable. It is easy to embed. And it's public. They're tweeting it publicly.
Why are we able to curate the best of, or when there's a big event, you know, everyone's like, oh, these are the best tweets that are talking about the AMAs. But we can't do, these are the tweets that are talking about.
These are the shameful most racist tweets. People that are on the internet.
We can celebrate. I find like we're in a place, a time, even though we do, the internet is there a lot of times, sometimes to put people down. We do it very publicly. But then it's also very much a celebratory place where it's like, oh, these are the most awesome this, we're curating this. But suddenly when people curate the worst this, the worst that, it's like, how dare you? You're making people, you're encouraging people to talk back to those people. And like, what's your responsibility in that then? I think we're figuring all of this out right now. But I think curating stuff that's horrible and that and things that maybe those people should take responsibility a lot of people tweet things thinking that, oh, no one's really listening, or they just put it out there and it doesn't really matter because
90% of the time, no one is listening.
Yeah. But the thing is, I don't think that's a good message to put across or promote, because the fact is, even if you're an unknown person, you don't need to be a celebrity or an internet star, you might say something, and whether it's amazing or not so amazing, and it's incriminating of some sort, or it's negative, it can have an effect. And that's, I think, not making those people take responsibility. That encourages people to start trolling, saying like, oh, well, no one's really listening to you. That's when you see those types of people go back and back and back and push and push and push until it's literally harassment and cyberbullying. And so, I mean, I think this is an interesting use of Twitter and curating these tweets to do it, not just for, you know, good things like curating the best of moments, but to say, oh, these are the best of moments in that thing that we should talk about. And it's not always fun to talk about these things, but it's happening. It's part of our culture. And we've done it in the past, you know, by putting talking heads out there and, you know, in media. And so this is our version of it, of doing it online.
I mean, in many ways, this is sort of the evolution of social norms on the internet. And I think that small structural changes can have a big impact. For example, I have no actual hard data to back this up, but on YouTube, I think most of us agree, I would much rather get paper cuts to the eyeballs than read YouTube comments about videos that I post, because there's something about, you know, the total anonymity about just the hateful things people say on YouTube. It seems to me that since, I think it was 2 months ago, they allowed you to flip and you start using your real name associated with your Google Plus profile on YouTube, that structural change of it being your actual name on there, I of the hateful comments that I see on YouTube about my idiotic hairstyle or what have you, it seems like almost never those come from somebody whose real name is being associated with it. Mm-hmm. So I think in that regard, this website, the hellothereracists.tumblr.com, is another structural change that sort of reminds people that what you are doing is in public and associated with your identity.
So we don't have any Twitter police or Facebook police, so citizens need to take it upon themselves to do these types of things.
Is citizens on patrol? Is police academy?
Is anonymity the enemy of civility?
I don't believe inherently it is. But what we're seeing though from technology is that is casual anonymity is dwindling, and instead we're starting to see persistent identities emerging on the internet.
Because there's a benefit for it. You know, now we have a baseline dialogue. There's a benefit for having your real name attached to it because you look more credible than somebody. Now it's like the difference between walking into a room with your face on and walking into it with, you know, a mask like from Point Break. You know, one person looks more credible than the other person. And now that we've normalized the idea that online communication is a thing, and it's a thing where, you know, business transactions happen, people propose to each other. Like, you know, now the societal worth is there for us to take it seriously.
Well, we've got a macrocosm of that. We've got the a microcosm. We've got the chat realm. In the chat realm, the people who have registered their names and who have been with us for a long time, we take their comments more seriously, even subconsciously, than someone who is still iPad
web 9344. Exactly.
And keep in mind also, like, we know these aren't their real names. I'm not saying that it's the authentic identity that, you know, necessarily corresponds with what's printed on your Social Security card, but it's a persistent identity that you continue to cultivate. And I think you nailed it, Justin, when you're talking about there's an advantage to having a persistent identity, which is why we see, you know, characters on Twitter and Facebook continue to build up this identity. Now, there's nothing to say that you can't have four or five different identities and behave differently on all of them, and none of them appear to be connected to each other. But I think for the most part, we anonymity as we knew it in the dial-up days of AOL chat rooms is completely dead.
The takeaway from this story, I believe we can all agree, is that Twitter is racist.
No! Sure. No! Twitter's filled with a cornucopia of delightful human beings, many of them just great humans and charitable individuals. And then there's like a fine dusting of racists. Just like
a
powdered
garnish.
Sugar.
A garnish.
Yeah, on a pastry.
We see half the country what they are, you know, red versus blue. I think we've seen that there's separation of the country. We're not all the same.
No, we're not. And in like my home state of Florida, we're still deciding what we are.
Red versus Blue is also a great Machinima series.
I know.
Check it out.
Bernie Burns.
No, but before we go any further, again, I got Leo jumping around like a madman over here. I know, Brian, you're puzzled, but you know, Leo, he's an important guy. His time is valuable. He can't always spend it, you know, every hour with us. So why don't we cut back over there and find out what he wants?
Friends, do you have old gear, old equipment? Do you have phones, tablets, computers you no longer want? Let me tell you what to do with those, my friends. My friends, use Gazelle.com. Gazelle, it's the easy way to sell your iPhone, your iPad, your MacBook, your smartphones, GAZELLE.com. I know you got them. I know you got a big drawer full of old stuff. Dvorak's got a whole room over a garage full of old stuff. Just think of how much money that's worth. Well, you don't even have to think. You don't have to guess. Just go to Gazelle. Get a 30-day quote. No obligation. Now, I like it that the quote's good for 30 days. That means you can decide later if you really want that iPad mini. But let's say you got an iPad. You bought it 7 months ago. And now Apple comes along with a new iPad, and you want it. Boy, it'd be nice if you get something for that old one. How about 525 schmackaroos? Whoa! This is a profit deal. Gazelle, it really is the best way to recycle. And yes, mostly Apple stuff, but they do take Blackberries, old HTC or LG phones, Motorola's, Nokia's. I got that Samsung Galaxy S3. It's factory unlocked. It's just gathering dust. I don't need it anymore. Let me just see what that's worth. 16 gigabyte. It's in good condition. By the way, you can be honest about the condition, and they have their data experts assess it, and if you underestimated the quality, if you said it was good when they consider it flawless, they actually will send you more money. I don't know why. Seems like that's bad business, but really they're very honest. They're great. Free of water damage, yes. Calculate how much is that? What? $241. I'm rich. Now throw that all in a box. Actually, they'll send you the box. In fact, and anything worth more than a buck, they'll pay the postage. So put it aside. Then when you get the box, throw it in there. You have 30 days. Like I said, that quote's good for 30 days, so you can decide later. And then, boom, you're going to get a check. You'll get cash or PayPal, or you get a Amazon gift card. I recommend that because you get 5% additional on the Amazon gift card. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E. It's the best way. You know, somebody wants that gadget. Why let it gather dust when you can have money? Gazelle.com. Try it today. You're going to love it. Or my name isn't G.I. Joe. And now back to Twit.
I don't want to backtrack, but this next story actually does come back into a little bit of our Google discussion. You may have heard about this. If you watch Twit at all, we covered this a lot because this is a huge, huge issue for us. A few weeks back, there was a decision by the South Carolina Supreme Court that they ruled against the 1986 Stored Communications Act in the case of this. It was an adultery case, a divorce, where they said that emails that you've looked at but then not deleted or not copied somewhere else, they are perfectly game for someone to go through them without violating the Stored Communications Act. This sent shivers through the industry, but at the time, a lot of us were saying, okay, this is one state. This decision is going to be overturned. I had a lawyer by the name of William Shapiro come on, and he basically said, look, don't worry about this. This is it's a little case that will go up against the Ninth Circuit. Last week, the DOJ, trying to justify their raid of Mega Upload, they responded to a lawsuit by a man, Mr. Goodwin, whose data was confiscated with all of Mega Upload servers. They argued that, well, they didn't need a warrant to go through his data. And I'm going to summarize here, because essentially they didn't seize data. They seized a server. And therefore, he had no recourse to complain about the fact that they went through everything he had stored. The reason why this is important is because if you do anything in the cloud, if you're an enterprise, a small business that has come to trust the cloud, this has a huge chilling effect on a $1 trillion investment. That means Gmail, Yahoo Mail, it means that Dropbox, it means that anything that you use in the internet that resides on a box that doesn't specifically belong to you can be searched through if anyone on that box does something illegal. I want to throw this to Brian first, because, Brian, I know that you are a stalwart defender of the government's ability to do anything they want. You believe that they're trying to protect us. You believe that they should have the right to go through this data without warrant.
Finally, right? Learn to love Big Brother.
That's right.
I'll tell you what, man. This is it's terrifying to me. Like, I try to wrap my mind around the very question, and I just want to curl up in a ball and start weeping, because it's like this is not only a question of what does the government have the right to do. This is a question about the very nature about what constitutes property. I mean, is your intellectual property a physical thing? Is your secrets a physical thing? And it's like, I don't even know where to begin this. And it makes me sad that it's going to take so long to hash it out in so many tiny court decisions like this. But I think you're right. We're seeing a massive. You probably heard a couple of weeks ago I was saying that in the future we're going to start to see. Not physical objects, but virtual objects be treated as real property. We're going to see people go to jail for stealing a digital sword that doesn't actually exist because it's a virtual environment. We're going
to
see people
go. Is it a real prison or a virtual prison?
You know what? Whichever one is going to hurt the worst. But and with that in mind, I mean, it's like I have no idea where this is going to go. And to be honest, I get agoraphobic when I try to wrap my mind around it. It's just too big.
Well, now, mind you, I mean, we're still talking about exactly what the limits for property rights are for, like, physical land. You know, we have eminent domain cases about what the government can and can't tell you, you know, that they are now buying from you whatever price they want. So this is really, I mean, like Brian put it very eloquently, this is just a new front in a conversation that we've been having for as long as the concept of property has existed. This is just something that we're going to have hash out. And the way that these conversations start is by saying, well, this guy is breaking the law. So it's easy for us to just take this, and it is hard for us, I'm speaking as the government, it is hard for us to delineate exactly what is your stuff where you've done nothing wrong and what is the bad stuff before we go through it, and is the act of going through it a problem?
Well, is it about the government taking initiative on this, or the companies like a Dropbox saying, okay, this is an issue. Our lives are going to be more in the virtual world in the future and in the cloud. And so we need to start creating the rules and regulations for that now. I think it's sometimes if the government's not going to initiate it, and you can't expect them to, because obviously why would they want those rules and laws to exist? Because it'll be easier for them to go in and kind of take other people's stuff, right? So I think it is the responsibility of all of these companies to band together and say, okay, we're going to create a regulation together that makes sense for what is owned, if it's on our server, but versus if it's in your little, it's like saying your storage area. Like obviously someone owns the building, but the stuff in your storage area is still yours, right?
Unless it falls into a storage war, which is apparently very popular these days.
Well, no, I think everyone's you're right here in that this is the law.
Like storage wars?
Like storage wars, right. I love storage wars.
Who doesn't?
I would totally buy everything. But the government is struggling to define what is property in the digital domain.
Why are we expecting them to define it? Shouldn't we all come together? Shouldn't like all the main companies who are building these clouds come together at a certain point with the government and say, okay, we need to create this. This is the standard right now. Tell us what you think would work. But the fact is, this needs to be established.
But, I mean, yes, and a lot of these companies do have their own, you know, restrictions on what can and cannot be seized by the government, and the warrants or you know, requests, even less than warrants, or the requests that they will respond to. The question is, when the chips are down and when the government comes to them and says, listen, there is XYZ on this and it looks legitimately terrible, will they give up the ghost and will they succumb to these kind of requests? We just saw a super high profile example of this with the whole General Petraeus issue, where they were using a technique that is apparently very popular with terrorists, where they don't send each other emails. They would just write drafts in Gmail and just leave the drafts in there and then exchange the username and password between each other. So they would just log into their other Gmail account and look at what the written draft was. And that's how they determined that they were in a relationship. Google gave up the information on that, you know, or they somehow found a way to figure out what these things are. So, you know, the question isn't whether or not people, companies draw lines in the sand. The question is whether or not they stay to those and whether or not they hold to those behind closed doors.
Well, it goes even beyond that. On last week's Twiet, I had another lawyer by the name of Dan Balliser.
A lot of lawyers.
By the way, I have a lot of lawyers in my family, too. But he basically gave a really good analysis of why we shouldn't freak out legally. That legally, this isn't a big a deal as I was making it to sound. But the problem is the cloud. So when we talk about storing things and sharing servers in, you know, up in the cloud, it's not about legality. It's really about perception. What business, what enterprise, what small business, what individual is going to put value data up into the cloud if he knows that at any given time his data could be seized for something that someone else on the server did?
Yeah.
Or that his data could be looked through by a government agency because they're on a phishing expedition.
Back to Justin's point, I mean, we kind of have that issue already with physical property when it comes to, ever since the last 20 years, as the government has decided it's okay to seize property wherever it finds drugs. And you have all these cases of people where it's like they had nothing to do with the crime. Their car just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And all of a sudden it's seized along with a bunch of other stuff. I mean, it's a terrifying issue from an abuse of power perspective, but as a more importantly as a PR thing for the cloud in general, because people are already nervous about storing their stuff in the cloud because they for the longest time perceived like, wait, it's just out there and I just have to trust some company that it'll be around. And of course, you know, here we are a decade into this cloud experiment, and I for one have finally come to associate that my data is safer in the cloud than it is on my own computer. Because they do things like back up their data responsibly. But now you're right in that it introduces this second completely different issue where it's like, okay, is it safe to have it on the cloud where it could be nabbed for wrongdoings by other people? And I don't know what the answer is.
You're talking crazy, man. Crazy.
I usually do, sir.
Let's get out of the cloud a bit. I mean, that's a story that's going to develop. We're going to hear more about it.
Keep your feet on the ground, Robert.
Your feet on the ground, your head in the clouds, and your bottom
but
of the
not
chair.
Your data.
Not your data, no.
Keep your data somewhere else in between the ground and the clouds.
Trust no one. That's actually the motto that we have.
Don't trust anyone.
Trust no one.
I do have a kind of survivalist sort of look with this mustache, though. I feel like I could be wearing fatigues and growing a victory garden in my basement.
I just want a photo of you with that mustache holding a Bowie knife, you know?
Yeah, I think we've got that. Chad, don't we have a photo right?
No,
from
we've
earlier
shown
in the program.
The
no,
almost.
I think we got to bring that back.
No,
because,
we don't. Yeah, we don't need
it's,
to.
It's good stuff.
Edward James Olmos is not listening to Alex Jones and becoming New World Order.
Okay. Now, this next story is delicious. And I really struggled to find a tech angle, but I did.
Yes.
Brian. What you know about ding dongs?
I know that once you eat a ding dong, nothing in the world tastes better than another ding dong. That's what I know, or knew, I should say.
I'm happy you didn't ask me that first.
Yes, yes.
Okay, no, of course.
I'm sad. She didn't ask me, or he didn't ask me that first.
No, that would
I'd
be
very
bad.
Excited. Yes. I'm a ho-ho man myself.
Twinkie.
Sure.
Yeah.
Went out of business, folks.
Yes. Okay. Now here's the question to you guys. I mean, do you really think like the brand has a value? And let's say Hostess, you know, stops making or whatever, that they don't nuke that asset, that brand name. Somebody's going to buy the Twinkies name and start making Twinkies, and it'll be pretty much the same, right?
Yeah, they're in bankruptcy court. I think on Monday, the New York Post reported, and it seems highly likely that we have not seen our last Twinkie. We might have seen our last Twinkie.
I think the biggest FU would be if like a vegan company bought it and like created like vegan Hostess chips and like super healthy Twinkies, like totally an FU to like all of those companies.
That'd be worse than George Lucas destroying my childhood. It's like, you know, all of a sudden Twinkies is a boring, tasteless
vegetable. No, but imagine
thing.
You could actually make them really, really tasteful. What is that?
What, tasteful? Like the Twinkies won't show up on HelloTheRacist.com?
Imagine they were really good and sweet and like they were all that, but they were healthy.
Including Hostess owned a couple health food or healthy trending kind of companies that wanted
trending.
To take on that mark. Well, you know, whatever. I mean, I don't want to call them health food, but it's like, you know, natural, organic, whatever nonsense people buy. But like, you know, the Twinkies are Twinkies. You know, they're terrible. We know they're terrible. We buy them because they are terrible. That's the beautiful thing about them.
I think like Kevin Smith should buy Twinkies.
Kevin Smith could have bought Twinkies and saved money from what. Let's leave it there.
The question is, listen, there's a whole component to this about X's and, or, you know, a bottom line for Hostess about, you know, they had an argument with their union and I have no idea exactly.
Yeah, the
who's
union,
right and
basically,
wrong.
And I listened to this on NPR because I wasn't really following. It's not like I was following this story for months. But yeah, they said that to the union, if you guys don't come back, if you don't stop the strike, that we're going to go out of business. We will go bankrupt. And they continued to push. And it's not like Hostess was like a really profitable, successful company.
No, they've been in and out of bankruptcy over the last 2 years, I think.
And so it's like they pushed them until the point they were like, now you're not even going to have your job back. So congratulations. Hope you're happy.
Well, yeah. I mean, and that's I don't know enough to completely put it on the unions and say that the unions mismanage things for their employees. But they are obviously in this situation. We will see whether or not, you know, I think that likely a lot of these brands that have a lot of value. I mean, obviously, listen, this was front page news. Every newspaper I saw walking down the street had, you know, big banner headline like Twinkiepocalypse. Everybody scream and light their couches on fire.
It's becoming like kitschy. Like it's like a kitschy story, right?
Yes.
Like people were creating Is it GIFs out of it or GIFs? I always say.
Oh, careful. Those are fighting words.
Yeah, I know.
No,
on
YouTube, I was saying there was a big, actually, debate on my channel between GIF and GIF. Anyway, but people, it became like some sort of viral thing. So, like, what can you do with a company like Twinkies and Hostess? Like, I think it's going to be someone who just, like, loved the brand because of the legacy it has and wants to just save it for everyone and bring it back. I don't know. Someone, like, some rich guy is going to buy it or something.
Cheryl, luckily, I've already figured it out.
What?
I figured out who needs to buy Hostess. I figured out how to turn the company around. I found out how to keep 18,500 jobs in the United States.
Go.
Okay.
Go. Drop some science on them.
That's right. And that is because they just announced that the first, now that it's legal in some states, the first marijuana dispensing vending machine will be available. Now, can you imagine putting marijuana and Twinkies and Ho-Hos in the same box? There's a technology angle.
That's interesting. There should be someone that just, like, a big marijuana dealer that just buys the company. calls it a day.
I mean, imagine that. He's like, oh, hi. My name is Joe Pot. I sell marijuana, and I bought Hostess.
Snoop Dogg should buy Twinkies.
Oh, my goodness. That he could be the new Hostess sponsor.
I'll tell you what. Yeah, 50 mascot. Cent had his own vitamin water. Why can't Snoop Lion have his own Twinkie?
Snoop is skinny, so he's going to prove you could eat Twinkies and not get fat.
Exactly. Well, now, I would say this. Number one, Father Robert, and can you show do you have the thing
I brought up there
so we can show people who are watching this on video? But this is an actual thing. They are looking to put out a marijuana vending machine, for which I don't exactly know. Like, I mean, you can't vend beer out of a machine. I don't know how you were able
but
to.
But, I mean, look, even here, they understand you got to have the snacks on this side.
Okay,
you got the pot on this side.
Okay, let me just say, theoretically, pot smokers aren't exactly the most foresight-gifted people on the planet. It's not like they're thinking ahead of time, like, well, you want to know what? I better stock up. You need that thing after. You need to find them. You need to follow them with the option to buy a Twinkie.
It's like a combo deal. You put in number 5, and you get your pot and, like, a 12-pack of Ding Dong.
See, no. What you should do is just have, like, that on Redbox boxes. And depending on the movie you want to buy, it should just give you an add-on option of, like, oh, wait, you want to see Your Highness? Would you like to for an added $40?
So you rent Gosford Park. It gives you some carrot sticks. You rent Battleship, and you get, like, 5 pounds a pot and all the
Exactly.
Hostess. I got it.
There we go.
See, we're coming up with business ideas. This is the kind of innovation
this
that drives American
business.
This is what
This Week in Enterprise Tech should be.
Oh, my
fired. Okay. Now, I let's stop with the pot for a second, because we've got the model of sobriety coming right back at us. Leo is waving his hand at me again, and this time it doesn't look like a happy wave, but let's find out what he wants.
It's upset because you were bogarting the show.
Actually, you know what this is? This is a it's a very uncomfortable device. This is a massager. Ah, oh, there you put that on your neck, see? Clamp that down and turn it on. I'm very relaxed now, which is the perfect frame of mind to talk about accounting. High stress subject, isn't it? You don't have to wear strange headgears. You just need to go to FreshBooks.com and suddenly your life will be much, much easier. I remember when I found FreshBooks. Actually, it was Amber MacArthur that first told me about FreshBooks in 2004. I was going crazy doing my invoicing, and this just turned my life around. FreshBooks.com. Over 5 million people use FreshBooks. 5 million people. You can try it free for 30 days. All the features, all the clients, all the everything you need. It's perfect for any small business owner. Very easy to use. You don't have to be an accountant to use FreshBooks, which is nice. Your accountant will love you, though, at tax time, because you're so organized. Automated late payment reminders for follow-up. You can get a live person anytime you call or email FreshBooks customer support. FreshBooks just does it all for you. And right now, 30 days free, all the features, clients, staff, everything with no limits at FreshBooks.com. Just mention you heard it on Twit. Visit the website, get the tour, see all the stuff FreshBooks can do for you. I love this new iPhone app they just released. This lets you not only keep track of time and hours, but actually bill people and keep track of expenses all on your iPhone. If you're in business, and I know a lot of you are, you know, designers or contractors, you know, you got to keep track of this stuff. Boy, this is great. FreshBooks.com. It will change your life, and you will no longer need to wear strange headgear time as it gets towards the end of the month. That's really the whole point of FreshBooks. FreshBooks.com. Just tell them you heard it on Twit, will you? Don't mention the hat, will you? Now we take you back to This Week in Tech.
Thanks,
Leo.
It seems
awfully suspicious that that Leo was just getting relaxed right after the marijuana story. I don't know.
He did seem as if the weight had been lifted off his shoulders, didn't he?
I'll tell you what, that box he's in right now, it looks like Method Man's tour bus.
Let's bring it home. Okay, so I've got a... This is... You'll see the title that we can see is Nerds. This is definitely a heavy, hardcore geek hardware story. It's all about afterlife for electric cars. So you've got a Prius, you've got a Volt, you've got a Leaf, whatever it might be. The big drawback, at least in theory, has always been, well, what you're going to do with those batteries? They're toxic, they're bad for the environment. And depending on who you ask, you're supposed to swap out your battery pack every 5 to 10 years. Well, there's been a group that has come up with a pretty novel solution. And what they suggest is that long after a battery has stopped providing enough power to drive a electric car, it could still be the battery backup for a house or a building if you combine them in several packs. I really, really like this idea. I think it's a really good use of battery cells. I think it's a nice idea to think about using them here rather than dumping them into a landfill. Thoughts?
Good. Recycle good. How about that?
I would like to say boo to this. I want all the batteries to be built into a castle for which we will live. No, it's great.
Okay. Seems smart. Seems practical.
Seems legit. Right?
No, it's pretty legit.
It's legit, but there were a few questions about exactly how you would do this. I mean, we've for a while spoken about having the ability to, say, on something like a Volt or a Tesla, be able to drop out a battery pack and swap it,
yeah,
so that you could continue going, you know, without having to buy a separate hybrid gas engine to power your vehicle. But there's so many unknowns about the conditions of battery packs. Actually, a really good story is Sandy, there were, what are those, the Fiskers? Those the super high-end electric cars. There were a bunch of them that ended up underwater during Hurricane Sandy, and they basically exploded because their battery chemistry just was not able to handle salt water. When you start taking battery packs that have 100,000 miles on them and you put them into a home with 4 or 5 other battery packs, what I'm concerned about is, I mean, you could get some serious issues. You could have houses. Oh, yeah.
I mean, look, there's no shortage of things to worry about putting massive battery electrical power. I mean, not only in the car, but in the home. I got to imagine that for the most part, you know, proper safety procedures would be taken care of on this. I mean, essentially, this is a really good judo move to take what is, I would say, relatively universally thought of as a negative associated with electric and hybrid cars, and turning it instantly into a positive. Is this anything that's been implemented, though, or is this just some gums flapping from some guy who has an idea?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. This is really heavy on the geek culture because there have been people who have done this with their Prius. In fact, they did it during Sandy. People who took it's like 400 volts coming off the battery pack in your Prius, and they inverted it, or they used it so that they could power their houses during the worst of the hurricane, during the worst of the power outages. So has it been done? Yes, on a one-on-one geek basis. But could you do it on an organized basis across many different houses with people who really know nothing about technology? That remains to be seen.
I mean, it's huge.
I think it's super cool. It's bringing more value to having those types of cars. A lot of people go, you know, obviously a lot of people are going hybrid. and all that. Now it's not necessarily the geeks anymore and the environmentally friendly folk. It's people that see the value in it from an economic perspective and also from an environmental perspective. But to show that it can bring more to the table, and it's not like you need to be a DIY expert to use it in that way. I think it's about making those things more practical and accessible. And I think now we're seeing people experiment doing something like this, but if someone could create a standard where that's possible and it's easy, I think that's definitely a great thing. A lot of people are using generators like right in their houses and didn't even realize that it creates carbon monoxide and died when Hurricane Sandy happened. A lot of people don't understand what to do in these types of situations. And I feel like hopefully we're not going to see this more and more, but natural disasters might happen closer to home more than ever before in the next few years. And we need to learn how to deal with that stuff and buy things in our lifestyle that help us with those types of situations.
I like that that philosophy. Yeah, you know, it may not incur an immediate net gain, but yeah, if we have our philosophy set on getting things that help us as we move along, as we continue, that's not bad. I've always imagined equipping our Prius, my family Prius, with a really nice voltage converter so that I could essentially run a camping site off of my Prius engine. It makes my go bag my car.
If they were smart, their next commercial would be that, right? It'd be like, it's about a lifestyle, which literally that makes into a lifestyle. It powers different things that you do, not just the car.
Well, I mean, listen, battery tech is the backbone evolution that is and will completely reshape culture. You know, it has been not only, revolutionary in terms of automobiles, phones, computers. The better we get at it and the more charge we can get on a smaller footprint, the more we are allowed to do, the more we can let our dreams kind of become realities. And, you know, the more that we take now that we've got these classes of high capacity batteries and figure out how to repurpose them, the better off we're going to be.
Brian, could you see yourself using something like this, a converted Prius, when the zombie apocalypse comes?
Yes. No. I stop badgering me. I don't know.
Muscle cars. No, muscle cars only.
Yeah.
Oh. Yes? No.
I said sure.
Yeah. Okay. Said in your face.
Said in my face. You know what? I'm gonna call it. I'm gonna say this. We did not too bad here, aside from the fact that I will probably get fired when the
well you, is that Tom over there waving his hands?
Wait, yeah. What is Mr. Ace the Tech doing? Yeah. You know what? Maybe you could tell us something about what's going on in the week ahead.
Good rebound, hey, thanks, Jeremy. Father Robert, doing a great job on this week in tech. There's some of the things we'll be keeping an eye on in the week ahead on Tech News Today. Of course, today Nintendo Wii U arrives in the U.S., so we'll talk a little bit probably about how it's selling, whether you can get one, all that sort of thing. Monday, November 19th, the PlayStation Vita launches its PS Plus service. Tuesday, November 20th, happy birthday to Windows. Wednesday, November 21st, happy birthday to Xbox 360. And Thursday, November 22nd is Thanksgiving. So no show here in the United States because Tech News Today will be celebrating Thanksgiving. But in Japan, the white slim PS3s will be available. That's a look at the week ahead. Back to you, Father Robert.
Thanks,
that's
Tom.
Brian's. My nickname for Brian is the White Slim.
The White Slim.
Yeah.
I thought he was the turkey.
No.
Okay. No, I do want to give my panel a chance. Thank you very much for coming on. Shira, what's going on with online with your presence with trends?
My presence?
Yeah.
Yes. How present are you?
Over. Like a battery charger. we're live daily, so we create content and we bring you the best the web has to offer, specifically in online video. If you had to watch 5 videos every day, we curate those videos for you, and we have amazing guests, so on and so forth. So this weekend's obviously Thanksgiving, but we're live every day, noon Pacific time, 3 p.m. Eastern, youtube.com/whatstrending. Blog, whatstrending.com, and 24/7 we are posting the videos that everyone is sharing. So we cut through the noise for you. We do the dirty work for you, so you don't have to.
So you bring us the best of the web.
Yeah, we bring you the best of the web. We're like, you know, the new MTV, the cool version, like in the early 90s.
Is this episode going to make the best of the web?
No.
Yes.
Oh, no.
I will be tweeting about this for the rest of my life.
Oh. No, you won't. Chad was saying that you're doing a big red carpet thing coming up too, right?
We have a bunch. I mean, we always have red carpet things coming up too. We have a bunch of big specials coming up. We're going to be doing a big live stream special from YouTube. They're opening their big studios on the 28th. Of November. We're also on December 2nd going to be hosting the red carpet for the Trevor Project, which is an amazing nonprofit helping with bullying and suicide prevention for the LGBT community. A lot of youth. So it's honoring Katy Perry. I'm
sure hey, look at that.
I'm sure a lot of the tech nerds are excited about that. And anyway, there's a ton of people that go there, but it's a great cause. I've been involved with their organization for the past year or so, and they do a lot of great work. And then we're going to be doing a big charity special, which we haven't really announced fully, with someone on the 13th. A big variety Christmas celebration. And so, you know, we're just thinking about outside the box of how we power content with using technology, and we kind of blend those two worlds, because this day and age, as you know, the future of Hollywood and media isn't just content based, but it's powered by the people that are innovating the tech around that. So how do you bridge that gap? And we're always thinking about how to do that.
And again, thank you for bringing a little bit of respectability to what has been. Well, by the way, this panel was booked weeks, months, years in advance. Just
sure.
Now. Yeah.
Oh,
that's how
yes.
on top of it you were, Father.
That, absolutely. Justin, what about you? What do you have going on?
Well, I'll tell you what. I'm really impressed with this youngster, Brian Brushwood, next to me. I think we should start a podcast together. What do you say about that one, Bri?
Oh, you know what? I'll invent a time machine immediately. We'll go back and create it 2.5 years ago, and we shall call it NSFW, the new show full of wind.
And lo, it should broadcast every Tuesday at 10 p.m., unless our schedules say otherwise, and we record it another day. And this Tuesday at 10 p.m., and Brian doesn't even know this, we will be welcoming back our friend Ali Spagnola. The Power Hour singer, who, by the way, brilliant concept. She decided to record 61-minute songs so you could play a Power Hour. If you're not familiar with this drinking game, you take a shot of beer with each minute that goes by. 60 original songs. But you want to know what? It's the holidays coming up. You ain't got time for an entire hour when you're dealing with family. She's debuting exclusively on NSFW the Ultra Quarter Power Hour. 15 songs, including a brand new original Thanksgiving theme song, which she will perform live this Tuesday on the Twit Network at 10 p.m.
That's spagalicious.
That's 10 p.m. Eastern time.
And you, Mr. Brushwood, I know you're a little bit busy, but what you got cooking?
A baby. We got 1 month left. This thing's going to pop on Christmas Eve, apparently. That's why a couple weeks ago you heard me mention, I'm pointing back behind me because that's where a couple of weeks is.
I put together the
website Scam Stuff. And we put, if you're trying to figure out what to do for Christmas, we made this little thing called the Scam Pack, which is, it's got 17 different gizmos and doodads that'll allow you to perform over 100 different tricks from Scam School. And we included a premium deck of Theory 11 cards from Shepard Fairey, the guy who does Obey Jaya, the guy who created the famous Obama picture. But anyway, it's really rad and it's a good value. And we're going to make them. We're going to live stream my whole family assembling for them and send them out to you. Just head on over to scamstuff.com, and it's pretty awesome.
If you've ever wanted to see a white sweatshop in action, finally, Brian provides to you that opportunity.
I do what I can.
Well, thank you. Thank you to all of you, especially on such a short notice. Thank you for, what has been an absolutely just fun episode of Twit. Also, special thanks to our producer and technical director, Chad. Chad, you want to give yourself a hand there?
Ah, thanks. Here, let me see if I can find a camera that points at me. Give myself a hand? A round of applause just for myself?
Chad, I hear that you actually have your own show.
And
on
also,
the
we're
Network.
Trying to fill out the time on this episode since it's been so short. Yeah, so, can you plug some things?
Yeah, I actually do a show called OMG Craft live on the Twit Network. You can go to omgcraft.com. That is a show all about Minecraft. So, if you want to get good with your Minecraft skills, every week I try to take a big topic and explain it to you. Last week we just did your email questions, so it's actually kind of a cut-up episode with a whole bunch of stuff for all you guys. So thank you.
You do a great
job.
I like
your hair.
Thank you.
I love his hair. Thank you. Cool hair.
Yeah, I match the pillar behind me. In fact, sometimes in the middle of the show,
he blends in.
I'll blend in, and my face will be the desk, and no one knows that I'm here.
That's right. And next week, Leo will be back. He'll be giving us some of the Twit goodness from after his long break in Australia. But until then, another Twit is in the can.
This is amazing. Oh. How did that feel? Describe it to me. What was that like?